Chapter 9. The Dream of Christian Rosycross, Part 1. In the 8th chapter, the meaning of the invitation to the royal wedding that Christian Rosycross received was explained. We determined that the content of this invitation points to a state of being that one can define as a birth, but then a birth with the most remarkable aspects, because this state of being entails a new radiation of the serpent fire, which first displaces and then replaces the age-old reality of consciousness. Therefore, we also speak of a certain anomaly that is referred to in the Bible as being in the world but no longer of the world. We could speak of a new power that appears in a temple that is still fundamentally unsuitable, with the holy binding elementary demand that this new power will only be able to make a very temporary use of this unadaptable temple. A new dwelling of a completely different nature and form has to be built, which corresponds with a completely different cosmos, a completely different field of life, and a completely different power radiation. In this initial process of original Genesis, we do not yet see transfiguration but transmutation, which makes the whole microcosm suitable to start with transfiguration. Transmutation is the progressive purification of the dialectical being, the collecting and arranging of new building materials. As soon as this work during the first birth is realized, the candidate advances to the second phase. He now focuses on taking leave of the old temple and the old field of life, and building the new or original human temple. When the third phase commences, this great work is accomplished, the candidate has again become a living soul as before, and he or she then goes the glorious path from the living soul to the life-giving spirit. It is self-evident that the pupil who begins the path deeply longs to be clothed with his garment of the original life, but it is clear before his consciousness that the work of transmutation in the old temple, which is in the world but not of the world, has first to be fully accomplished. Therefore, although he must know that end goal, he will not remain staring in sickly exaltation at the final goal of the path, but will place himself in the now. He or she knows that the soon will come, but only the now is real and actual, and even though the now is a blessing, in the light of the final goal, it is evidently still defective. Therefore, one is glad for what one is, not out of self. Satisfaction, but because of the actual living vibrating now, in which there is a colossal amount to be done for others and oneself. That is why the Sermon on the Mount places the actual now before the pupil on the path. Do not worry about tomorrow. Matthew 6:34. The majority of our companions in this world run and chase for the future. People flee in fear and panic from the now. We must understand that eternity can and must be grasped in the now. Whoever is permitted to celebrate the glory of the primary birth of the serpent fire, even in a body that is bowed with pain, old age, or grief in the cruelty of the interplay of opposites, stands in the unfaltering light of eternity. Such a person rejoices in the gladness of the actual now. Do you already know this gladness in the now? To know, I stand in the unshakable. I stand in the living chain that reaches from here into eternity. Do not rejoice too quickly, superficially. If your cornerstone is not strong enough, disappointment will be your share. Take care also not to gloss over the now. There are people who want to conceal their pitiful and gloomy now behind an outer semblance and untruthfulness, and by ever diverting others from attention to the now. Before you are able to taste the eternal joys of the new reality, you will have to fully and consciously undergo the pain and division of the now, from which you want to flee like everyone else. The dialectical human being is a greatly divided soul. He does not eat the fruits of the tree of life. He is unable to do so, and is obliged to be content with the fruits of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The good in him has no static value. It perishes. It is not fundamental. It is not made of a material from which building stones can be formed. It is the fleeting, unreal opposite pole of the fundamental evil in his whole being. We know this. But do we acknowledge it before our inner tribunal? That is what the law of self-knowledge requires. The key to the path lies in the fulfillment of this law. All mysteries to this day have conveyed to us this requirement, the complete admission of one's own state of being before the inner tribunal. Such a confession of the now must be put before the now, of which Paul says, "For I have learned, in whatever state I am, to be content." The old mystics called this the admission of guilt or debt. But how great is the misunderstanding of its true meaning? In our culture, the admission of guilt is a tactic applied in various ways to gain remission or a better position, an advantageous relationship for a pursued goal. When the spiritual school deals with the activity of the law of self-knowledge, it means something else entirely. Here, it is not a matter of admitting social scandal, corruption, deceit, or gross materialism, for whoever is still in that state should not strive for the temple of initiation. Such a person first needs rehabilitation by the Salvation Army or a similar institution. The forecourt of the Rosy Cross is not an establishment for the socially or morally inadequate, which of course does not say that such people deserve no compassion or that they should not be offered help. Neither is the school of the Rosy Cross meant for the perfectly content, for healthy people who do not need a doctor. It is for the Ephesians, that is, people of a certain ethical state of life, people who actually live by high moral, social, mystical, and intelligence standards. Only they can be admitted to the school. Why is that? Because the morally deficient, in a dialectical sense, still need dialectical expansion. Do grasp this well, because they are still weighed down by karma, under a karmic burden that can only be settled in this nature amidst dialectical interrelations. Someone with such a karma, with such conditions in the auric being, cannot omit one step, but she can be helped by brotherhoods of a specific nature. The law of self-knowledge concerns only those who stand at the border of their dialectical field of activity, those to whom it can be said, "I know your works, your effort, and your patience, and that you cannot bear evildoers, and you have tested those who claim to be apostles but are not, and you have found them false. You have persevered and have endured hardships for my name and have not grown weary." Revelations 2:2-3. These people, who in loving service and effort have penetrated to the border of their possibilities and beat on the walls to get through, must understand why the walls are there. They will have to understand from where and from what height they have fallen, namely, the height of the original life, the mountain of the spirit. They will have to completely penetrate into the restrictions, the knowledge of the structural and fundamental deficiency of their natural dialectical state. They must experience the anguish of their state, not in emotion, tears and self-pity, but in full consciousness, in the light of the subconscious knowledge of the divine reality. When the ancient mysteries speak of a broad chasm, the river of death, the Styx, which lies between the here and the temple of initiation, then understand fully that this has to do with the fundamental chasm between dialectics and divine reality. The pupil must be conscious of this. He or she must be aware of the guilt or debt and confess it openly before the inner tribunal. Why consciousness of guilt? Is not consciousness alone sufficient? In that case, consciousness would only be the experience of the impediment. Consciousness of guilt goes infinitely far deeper. The Ephesian is thereby mindful that he has renounced his first love, the living soul state in the divine reality, and experiences completely from what a dizzying height he has fallen. Therefore, it must not be only experience, but conversion, turning back to the fullness of the divine love reality. Who has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the community. They who have ears and understand and act accordingly, the ferryman of the Styx comes and takes them across the river of death. Who, as an Ephesian, possesses the precious jewel of pre-remembrance, is called from day to day to the royal wedding. He stands on the bank of his river with bowed head and arms crossed. She feels like Christian Rosycross after he received his call. He breaks out in a cold sweat, for although he clearly recognizes that this is the previously announced wedding, he never imagined it would take place on such difficult terms. At the same time, he experiences his gross misunderstanding, his blindness, the limitations of his personality, his mode of life, and his brotherly love towards his neighbor. He experiences his binding with ordinary nature. While he hovers between hope and fear, and ever examining himself finds only weakness and impotence, he finally resolves to follow his usual way. He says an ardent prayer and lies down to sleep in the hope that divine guidance will speak to him in a dream, which, praise be to God, does indeed happen. It is indeed a fact that every candidate, before being invited to the wedding, receives notification of it beforehand, long before, 7 years before. You should not think of 7 times 365 days, but of a cyclic timescale of preparation whose signs can be read in the sense centers of one's own auric sphere. It concerns a specific quality of contact by the brotherhood in which the future candidate lives. His now is characterized by extraordinary occurrences. She is being prepared for the path. When the invitation then comes, the pupil is standing at the bank of his Jordan in a complete, deeply engraved consciousness of guilt. Thus, hovering between hope and fear, he goes to meet the dream during sleep. Do not make the classic mistake of associating the sleep meant here and its consequences with what you understand by sleep and dream. Christian Rosycross does not remain in the restraints of his consciousness of guilt. When this experience is deeply etched into his being, there is no longer any question of continuing self-mortification as the mystics did and still do, but he enters a state of absolute rest, the state of not doing, as Lao Tse called it. It is the state of not my will, but your will be done. It concerns merging into the state that the psalmist called the shelter of the Most High. Whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High, who passes the night in the refuge of the Almighty, will say to the Lord, my refuge and my stronghold, my God in whom I trust. Because he will rescue you from the snare of nature and from the sorely pernicious state, he will cover you with his wings. And in the refuge of his wings, you will trust. His truth is unfaltering. Free rendering from Dutch version of Psalm 91, 1-4. While the candidate spends the night in this refuge, the ferryman comes to take him across the river.